Many around the world will watch as President Biden ends a ban on aid to groups offering abortion-related care.
We really don't have any business causing such kind of chaos and destruction for really politicizing what should just be a health issue.
I'm Marco Werman. Today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. In Austria, some survivors are marking it with a COVID vaccine.
And they will soon have a chance to be closer with their family, their children, grandchildren, and so on.
And bucking traditional stereotypes, some Arab women just want to climb the world's highest mountains.
People ask me, Mona, are you married? I'm like, yes, married to the mountains. I'm in a polygamous marriage, literally, because I love the mountains.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Thanks for making it here this Wednesday. Today, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a confirmation hearing for President Joe Biden's nominee to represent the U.S. at the United Nations. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is a veteran diplomat with more than 30 years of experience at the State Department. The World's Rupert Shenoy starts us off with this report.
Senators from both parties today asked Linda Thomas-Greenfield again and again about how she views the threats posed by China and how she would confront those threats if she's confirmed as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
We know China is working across the U.N. system to drive an authoritarian agenda that stands in opposition to the founding values of the institution, American values. Their success depends on our continued withdrawal. That will not happen on my watch.
Some Republican senators questioned that commitment. They referred to recent editorials that described an October 2019 speech by Thomas Greenfield. She spoke at a Chinese government-funded Confucius Institute at Savannah State University, a historically black college in Georgia. She said she came to regret giving that speech, but added it was important for her to visit the school and highlight a serious problem, that there's a lack of diversity at the State Department.
Truthfully, I wish I had not accepted this specific invitations, and I came away from the experience, frankly, alarmed at the way the Confucius Institute were engaging with the black community in Georgia.
Thomas Greenfield said she strongly supports the crackdown on Confucius Institutes in the U.S., and she said she would not hesitate to call out the Chinese government as U.N. ambassador.
None of us want to encourage or support a conflict, and that is not the intent here. The intent here is to encourage the Chinese to change their behavior.
Asked about China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims in its western Xinjiang province and the Trump administration's last-minute designation of the situation there as genocide, Thomas Greenfield cited her experience as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs.
I lived through and experienced and witnessed a genocide in Rwanda. So I know what it looks like. And I know what it feels like. And this feels like that. We just have to call it for what it is.
Thomas Greenfield said it was important for the U.S. to continue to give diplomatic and military support to Taiwan, a territory China claims as its own. She said Iran must be held accountable for its nuclear activities and that she would work with both the Russian and Chinese governments to keep the pressure on Iran to stop uranium enrichment. At the same time, Thomas Greenfield said she would not hesitate to criticize Russia on human rights, citing the opposition leader Alexei Navalny's recent arrest and the ensuing protests in Russia. Thomas Greenfield was also questioned about her support for Israel. The Trump administration withdrew from the UN Human Rights Council because of a perceived bias toward Israel.
I look forward to standing with Israel, standing against the unfair targeting of Israel, the relentless resolutions that are proposed against Israel unfairly.
Thomas Greenfield, who was raised in the segregated South and attended segregated schools, is not the first African-American or African-American woman to represent the U.S. at the U.N. If confirmed, she would be the first Black American in the role to not be a first. New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker still celebrated her nomination.
Because I know the challenges we still have in this country. And I watched after George Floyd was savagely murdered, how it wasn't just all 50 states of America that came out and protested, but we saw other nations, right? At least a dozen other countries because they know that the United States of America, if we can make our values true here, there's hope for the world. Would you agree with that?
Yes, sir.
For the World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Today, the U.S. and Russia extended a key arms reduction agreement, the New START Treaty. The treaty first came into effect about 10 years ago and was set to expire next Friday. Lynn Rustin worked on the treaty during the Obama administration. She's now the vice president for global nuclear policy at NTI, the Nuclear Threat Initiative. Lynn, thanks for being with us. Explain, first of all, what the New START Treaty is and how it actually limits both the U.S. and Russia's nuclear arsenals.
Thanks for having me. The New START Treaty is the only treaty remaining that limits U.S. and Russian nuclear arms. It has numerical limits on deployed nuclear warheads, 1550 on each side. And importantly, it has very intensive, intrusive verification and inspection measures so that we can confirm that Russia is complying with the treaty. This includes 18 on-site inspections each year in each other's countries.
So you've been working on arms reduction for some time. It was in 2010 and 11 when New START was being negotiated with the Russian government. Take us back, if you would. What were those negotiations like?
Well, I supported those negotiations from Washington, but we were negotiating in a circumstance when the original START 1 treaty was set to expire. And basically, for 50 years, the United States and Russia have had a succession of agreements regulating their strategic nuclear arms. And so it was critically important to put the next agreement in place, which New START was. It was negotiated fairly quickly in about a year, and then it took some months to get it ratified and entered into force.
So if New START were to have expired on February 5th, what would have been the potential dangers and the impact to global security?
Yeah, I just can't stress how critically important it is that this treaty is being extended. In the intervening period, we've seen a succession of treaties fall by the wayside, either because in one case Russia violated one, the United States has withdrawn from treaties, frankly, under the Trump administration. There was kind of an aversion to arms control agreements. And so the whole fabric of arms control agreements that help regulate nuclear competition has been eroding. And this is the last standing treaty governing the most destructive weapons in the world on the part of the two countries that have by far the preponderance of these weapons. And so having the limits, having the verification in place for another 5 years is essential.
Aside from a New START, are there other agreements that put limits on U.S. and Russian nuclear arms? I mean, does New START cover all nuclear weapons?
It is the only agreement remaining, but it does not cover all types and classes of nuclear weapons. And so the next stage of arms control is going to need to do a couple of things. One is hopefully begin to address what is not covered in this treaty. That includes all nuclear warheads. And also we have the problem that the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty has been terminated. And so we now have a class of intermediate range systems that can be armed with nuclear weapons. And then third, there's a whole set of technologies that don't really lend themselves as much to formal arms control.
Like what?
Well, for instance, cyber risk to nuclear command and control systems. Mm. And those risks can come from third parties as well. It's really essential that our systems be hardened against cyber intrusions. And so that's really critical to begin to at least discuss that problem with Russia and kind of identify the mutual interest in not messing around in that way in each other's nuclear command and control systems.
You kind of tipped to it there. I'm wondering how the world has changed since New START was originally signed. And if you could do it all over again, Lynn, what would you change?
I don't know that the point is to go back and do something all over again. I think the point is to build on where we are. One thing that's also a good start by President Biden is he's setting a tone that says, we will cooperate with Russia in areas where it's in the United States' interest, even as we're firm on areas that we differ in terms of principles and values. And clearly, nuclear risk reduction and nuclear nonproliferation is an area where we are, as someone once said, doomed to cooperate with Russia. So getting on a path where you can have diplomacy, even with adversaries like Russia, to work on common problems and reduce risk, even as you have differences in other areas of the relationship, is essential.
Lynn Rustin is the Vice President for Global Nuclear Policy at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, talking to us about the Biden administration and Russia agreeing to extend the New START Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty. Good to speak with you, Lynn. Thank you.
Thank you.
76 years ago today, January 27th, 1945, soldiers from the Soviet Red Army liberated the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp in occupied Poland. More than 1 million people, most of them Jews, were sent to gas chambers at the Nazi camp or died from starvation, cold, and disease. This year, most international Holocaust Remembrance Day commemorations are being held online because of the pandemic. In Israel, home to many Holocaust survivors, fewer will be present for such remembrances. About 900 Holocaust survivors died of COVID-19 in Israel last year, a fifth of the country's COVID deaths. In Austria, the Jewish community in Vienna is marking the anniversary in a unique way that's both symbolic and life-saving. They've arranged for more than 400 Jewish and non-Jewish survivors to get their first dose of COVID vaccine. Erika Jakubowicz is the director of the Jewish community of Vienna and organized today's vaccination drive. She joins me from Vienna. And I gather you're at the drive right now, Erika. Describe to us what's going on. What have you been seeing today?
So we had almost 400 people already here for the vaccination day. Everybody's very, very happy and relieved that they finally can get the vaccination. Vaccination started in Austria very late, and there is also not enough vaccine, and we are happy that there is something that we can do for the Holocaust survivors. I think it's our obligation to take care of our most vulnerable group in the community.
What made you decide to arrange this event? I mean, these survivors, given their age, aren't they already in the front of the line for vaccines in Austria?
No, only the people who have been in old age homes were vaccinated. All the other people, not yet. And as I am a daughter of Holocaust survivors, of survivors of Auschwitz, and my grandparents were killed there, I think this is something that I owe to my family and to other family like mine.
Mm. And the 400 or so survivors who have been on the receiving end of these vaccines today, how have they taken in this event? What does it mean to them?
I would like to mention that we have also some elderly people at the age of 85 plus who are not Holocaust survivors, who came from other areas like the former Soviet Union. And the Ministry of Health has also asked us to vaccinate them. And I immediately said, of course, we do it. We had contact with each of those people, and they are very thankful and happy that they had a chance to get the vaccination, and they will soon have a chance to be closer with their family, their children, grandchildren, and so on.
There are approximately 240,000 Holocaust survivors in the world. They're all elderly, and each year their numbers drop. What do we need to do to keep the memory of the Holocaust and its victims alive in this challenging time?
That is really a very, very good question. I think we have to find new ways of remembering, because we are talking to a much younger generation who has no, even if they, you know, they get a certain education in school, but it's so far away that they have no idea what really happened, what it means. And we have to find really new ways how to keep the memory. But I don't have an answer how to do it yet.
I mean, we do have books, there are movies, there are documentaries. I mean, what else is there to kind of bring people to this history?
The books and the movies and everything is very, very important. But you know it like I know it. If you're talking to people in the age of, I don't know, between 15 and 30, a lot of them are not interested in this movie, are not interested in the book. So we have to find new ways. We have to work with the new media. This is something that people in education systems, I think, and others have to find new tools.
Erika Jakubowicz is the director of the Jewish community of Vienna and organizer of today's vaccination drive for survivors of the Holocaust. Erika, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Coronavirus vaccination campaigns are underway in a lot of wealthy countries around the world. Meanwhile, there are many less well-off countries that have yet to see a single vaccination. The head of the WHO, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said this week that not sharing the vaccine globally is a problem for many reasons.
It wouldn't just be a moral failure. It would be an economic failure.
Ghebreyesus said if low- and middle-income countries are not able to vaccinate their populations, the entire global economy will take a major hit. He pointed to new studies that support this, including one commissioned by the International Chamber of Commerce. Selva Demirel was an economist at Koch University in Istanbul and worked on that study. Selva, what will happen to the global economy if wealthy countries monopolize vaccine supplies? What's your conclusion?
So our conclusion is that there's going to be a high economic toll that will be paid by advanced economies. Look, if you think that it is too much to contribute to COVAX, which is about $27 billion at the moment, you're going to pay much more if you don't actually help out to produce and distribute the vaccines in a more equitable way.
And COVAX, as we know, that's the global effort to share vaccine.
Yes. So our assumptions are, let's say advanced economies, the rich economies, vaccinate their populations in about 4 months, let's say in the first half of 2021. Meanwhile, emerging markets and poorer nations only can vaccinate half of their population for the entire 12 months of 2021. What would be the consequent economic costs? That's the question that we ask. There is this misperception that once an economy vaccinates itself, it is going to just eliminate all the drag from the pandemic. But we highlight that that's not the case because economies are not islands and they are connected to each other through trade relationships. So even though you can eliminate the vaccine at home, you will still suffer from the pandemic because your trade partners are not vaccinated.
So you're looking at a series of knock-on effects and ultimately a huge price tag. So far, though, a lot of the one percenters have not taken a big economic hit, as you're suggesting. Wall Street and stock portfolios continue to grow. Can you give us a concrete example of how a lack of vaccines in, say, sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America, how that's going to be felt on Wall Street?
For example, let's say United States versus Turkey, two trade partners. United States is vaccinated and Turkey is not vaccinated. Well, United States will sell less to Turkey. And second, U.S. also buys imports from Turkey, and in particular, imports of inputs or intermediate goods. You, for example, buy steel from Turkey and make a car in the United States. But if Turkey cannot produce that steel because there are lockdowns, people get sick, they cannot go to work, then steel production in Turkey is going to go down. U.S. imports from Turkey of steel is going to go down. As a result, U.S. car production is going to go down. So we do this for 65 countries with input-output linkages to see the total effect of export decline and import decline and the overall production. And when we add this up, we see that advanced economies are going to pay up to 50% of the total costs, which is going to be trillions of dollars. So if you compare this to that $27 billion needed to generate more vaccination, to vaccinate 20% of the world population that expressed by the COVAX initiative, then you see that the decision is quite trivial, that investing in these type of efforts to produce more vaccines for the world population is actually well worth the buck because you're actually going to save trillions of dollars in exchange for compared to trillions of dollars, negligible amount of investments to produce and distribute vaccines.
You know, we tend to talk about sharing the vaccine as a question of charity. The wealthy can afford to be generous and should be. Is that how economists like you see it, Selva?
Actually, we don't think this is an act of charity at all. This is an act of rationality. It is for the best economic interest of the wealthy nations to provide necessary investment for a more equitable vaccine distribution. Because if you don't do this, the economic costs that you have to bear, the decline in your GDP is going to be much more than how much you have to invest in order to provide a more equitable distribution. This is really a no-brainer for us.
Selva Demiralp is an economist at Koch University in Istanbul. She's one of the authors of a new study describing the global economic price of failing to share coronavirus vaccines. Selva, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Sharks are in trouble. That's the headline from a scientific study published today in the journal Nature. Sharks, as well as rays that live in the open ocean, have declined by about 70% in the past half century because of overfishing. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
If you are a shark living in the open ocean, you've evolved over hundreds of millions of years to swim and hunt, often from the very top of the food chain. But when your survival also hinges on the whims of humanity, you've got some strikes against you. First, your territory doesn't neatly match up with national maritime boundaries.
White sharks especially have incredibly long movement patterns. They'll move from Australia through to New Zealand and around ocean basins.
George Roth is a marine ecologist at the University of Queensland.
Which makes them very hard to protect because their global footprint is larger than the management of individual countries.
Next, sharks reproduce slowly, and many humans consider their meat and fins quite tasty. Then, of course, there's the image problem.
Especially in the 80s after Jaws came out, there was a lot of fear of sharks in the ocean.
Unlike cute and cuddly threatened species like pandas, say,
very few people would be interested in saving shark populations when they perceive them as being a threat, which often can be very far from the truth.
Add all this up and you get today's news. There are 31 shark and ray species that live in the open ocean. 3/4 of them are now considered threatened. Sonia Fordham is president of Shark Advocates International, part of the Ocean Foundation, and one of the authors of the study published today.
We've been sounding the alarm for a long time, but these numbers are quite steep and sort of unprecedented in terms of decline.
The problem for sharks that live in the open ocean is the same as for those that live in coastal waters or near reefs.
Overall, for these species and for all sharks and rays, the main threat to their populations is overfishing. So that can come in the form of allowing the intentional take of too many.
Or sharks getting caught up in gear designed to catch tuna or swordfish. This study, she says, is
really making it clear that even the makos, shortfin makos, are the world's fastest shark. You know, that's not helping them outswim the kind of vast fishing fleets that we see today.
In the past few decades, sharks have increasingly been seen as wildlife in need of protection. The first two shark species were added to the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species in 2003. But in many countries and for many species, conservation agreements haven't translated into catch limits or bans, Fordham says.
There's been much discussion. There are global commitments, there are regional commitments, and it's just time to follow them up with concrete action. But we're running out of time.
The good news, Fordham says, is that conservation measures can be successful if they're passed. Hammerhead shark populations, for example, are recovering in parts of the Atlantic thanks to strictly enforced quotas. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
More ahead in the next half hour of the show. You're listening to The World. Tomorrow, President Biden will end a policy that blocks foreign aid for groups that even mention the word abortion. One nurse in Kenya doesn't want to see another president bring the policy back.
If it is not permanently repealed, it means that we forever are at the mercies of who comes in.
Lifting the global gag rule, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today, the Biden administration has signed a bunch of executive orders dealing with climate change, among them a pause on oil and gas drilling on federal lands and a commitment to make environmental justice part of the mission of every federal agency. Today, we're looking at the order that elevates climate change to a national security issue. Erin Sikorsky is a former deputy director on the National Intelligence Council. She led the U.S. intelligence community's climate security analysis until last year. Erin, thanks for being here. How much is climate change currently factored into assessments of national security, and how would this order change that?
Thanks, Marco. Currently, it's not factored in nearly enough. The intelligence community and the national security community has not had the directive from its most senior customer, the President of the United States, asking them to do it. And now that President Biden has stepped up and said this will be central to his foreign policy, they will respond to that demand. The order he signed today called on all agencies to develop strategies for integrating climate considerations into their work. And that's huge. That's a big step forward from even where we were in the Obama administration.
Yeah, when you were in the government leading climate security analysis for the intelligence community, what were the kinds of threats you were looking at and how were your assessments put to use?
So we looked at how climate change intersects with other key national security issues, whether it's, you know, competition with China or the risk of conflict in places like the Middle East and Africa. We did include it in the Worldwide Threat Assessment, which comes out every year from the Director of National Intelligence, because we, the intelligence community, is committed to telling policymakers what those threats are, even if they don't want to hear it. But now that you have this demand signal from the president, that will elevate this to a more intense and senior focus.
Yeah, so now that climate change is baked into national security, what more should the intelligence community be doing as climate change becomes a bigger and bigger thing?
It should be integrating it into all of its analysis. So not just from a functional perspective with climate folks looking at it, but folks who are looking at China, at the Middle East, at Latin America, Brazil, for example. My organization just did a big report on climate security in Brazil. They need to understand how climate change is shaping those countries and those environments. So it needs to be integrated all across. And the intelligence community also needs to build out its cadre of experts who have scientific backgrounds and experience to bring that experience to bear on these issues.
President Biden is ordering the Secretary of Defense to do a climate risk analysis of the Pentagon's infrastructure. Doesn't the military already take climate change into account? And how would this executive order be different? What could we see at military installations and with military strategy?
Sure. You're right, Marco. Over the past, you know, 4 years or so, we've seen bipartisan action in Congress to push forward climate security measures, particularly regarding the Pentagon and asking them to make sure climate is integrated. This will, though, give the Pentagon, again, that senior level top cover to make sure that they're doing it on a regular basis. Hopefully, this is just a first step that will be followed with some budgetary measures as well to give them the funding they need to do this. And they'll have a champion at the White House, both in the form of Special Envoy John Kerry, but then also in the president, who will be pushing this forward for them.
Right. John Kerry, Biden's climate envoy, and he's going to have a seat on the National Security Council. What difference will that make in security planning? And what models are there to look at when thinking ahead?
The difference it'll make is that, again, it will be integrated throughout because, you know, climate change is one term that's been used for it within the national security community is a threat multiplier. And what it really does is it makes other threats more acute and it shapes the trajectory of these threats. So if you're not having someone in the room who can talk about that in the situation room when you're discussing different threats, you're going to miss potentially key issues. So having Secretary Kerry there will make a big difference, and it'll send a signal to more junior folks across the government that they better understand this and take it seriously.
Just one last thing, Aaron. I'd love for you to give us an example of a security situation in recent years where climate change, taking that into a consideration, would have really been useful.
Sure. Well, I think you can look at the Middle East, for example, and the conflict in Syria there. There are a lot of different drivers of that conflict. One driver, however, was the drought that happened pre-conflict there, and understanding how climate change shaped the drought and rain patterns there and weather patterns would have brought a better understanding of the severity of the issues there. So bringing climate change into the mix before the conflict, there's been a lot of done work since the conflict to understand that, but ahead of time. Fortunately, we now have the modeling capabilities to do that kind of foresight and that work. And that's one of the things the intelligence community should really be doing going forward.
Aaron Sikorsky, Deputy Director of the Center for Climate and Security, updating us on the president's new executive order focusing on climate change and national security. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Tomorrow, many around the globe will be watching when President Joe Biden is expected to reverse a Trump administration order, a policy that has severely impacted women's health and health in general globally. The World's Alana Gordon has this report.
The pandemic has been challenging for so many women and girls. In Kenya, Nelly Munyezia has been documenting a rise in gender-based violence, teen pregnancies, unsafe abortions, and even deaths. She's a nurse by training and director of Reproductive Health Network Kenya. In May, her group launched a 24-hour hotline. It's called Nena Na Binti. Nena means speak. And
Binti is a Swahili name, which means like an aunt. You know, in Kenya, an aunt is a trusted person a person that a girl while growing up, you will trust her with all your issues, all your sexual and reproductive health issues. So it's like speak to an aunt.
Munyezia says this is important because there's lots of fear and stigma in talking about sexual health. Through the hotline, people are able to directly link up with care in their communities.
And this was basically responding to the needs of women and girls who had been violated, who needed access to contraceptives, who needed access to safe abortion. And as due to COVID lockdown and restrictive movement, they were not able to access these services.
But Munyezia says the problems run much deeper than the current coronavirus outbreak.
This is, you know, not only attributed to probably the pandemic, but when we take it back to 2018, 2019, access to services has become a challenge.
She says her group used to do a lot more across the entire country: pap smears and cervical cancer outreach, HIV services, family planning, and abortion. But a change in U.S. policy abruptly pulled their eligibility for global aid. So they had less funds for these services. In his first week in office, President Trump signed an executive order as journalists snapped photos. Okay. It's known as the Mexico City policy, but critics call it the global gag rule. It basically meant that any groups around the world that actively perform or promote abortion were no longer eligible for U.S. global aid, even if that money was used for something totally separate. Jennifer Popick is legislative director at the National Right to Life Committee.
No matter your feelings on abortion, should federal dollars be funding it? That's something that's enjoyed long, you know, history of bipartisan support among people. And so we were happy to see that this policy was reinstated during that time.
Popick says reinstated because the policy has actually been around for a long time. It was first enacted under President Ronald Reagan and has yo-yoed back and forth, revoked and reinstated with each Republican or Democratic president. Trump expanded the rule and applied this condition to billions more in aid. For Terry McGovern, chair of population health at Columbia School of Public Health, the hit on reproductive health services globally cannot be understated.
We really don't have any business causing such kind of chaos and destruction for really politicizing what should just be a health issue.
As one example, MSI International, which offers health services, including abortion, in dozens of countries, lost millions in U.S. aid. They estimated the disruptions in contraceptive services led to millions of unintended pregnancies and hundreds of thousands of unsafe abortions around the world.
This doesn't achieve what it's supposedly set out to do, which is reduce abortion.
Activists say the U.S. policy has sent a powerful message, furthering the stigma and fear around sexual and reproductive health in communities. It disrupted HIV care and other health services, too. But now they are readying for a big change and a counter message. President Biden is expected to rescind this policy tomorrow in an executive order. Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, recently spoke to the World Health Organization about the upcoming move.
It will be our policy to support women's and girls' sexual and reproductive health and reproductive rights in the United States as well as globally to protect women's health and advance gender equality at home and around the world.
For Nelly Munyezia in Kenya, this week marks a life-saving moment for women.
Of course, we are all excited and we are all hopeful right now. But again, we want to be very realistic and know that the damage might take quite a bit of some time before we start seeing the benefits.
She and others are now pushing for a permanent reversal, as in a ban on the policy once and for all.
If it is not permanently repealed, it means that we forever are at the mercies of who comes in.
Legislation introduced in 2019 in Congress would do this and permanently end the policy. And so Munyezia says this week marks only the tip of the iceberg in what's needed to safeguard women's health beyond any one U.S. administration or any one pandemic. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
Less than a year ago, when the pandemic first showed up, lots of people busted out their sewing machines to make cloth face masks. Ella Lambert, a college student at the University of Bristol in the UK, had another idea. If you can sew a cloth mask, you can also sew a cloth sanitary napkin, a menstrual pad. Her organization, the Pachamama Project, recruits volunteers to sew these pads, then works with aid groups to distribute them to refugees in Lebanon and Greece. Ella Lambert joins us now from Chelmsford, Essex in the UK. Where did this idea come from, Ella?
Well, I had a really bad episode of period pain during the first lockdown, and sitting there in bed, you know, turning off my laptop and shutting off the online university, which I was having to attend every day. I felt very privileged that I was able to do that. And I was thinking about all the people in refugee camps or in situations where they can't afford sanitary products who are dealing with that kind of pain, and how that must just be such an extra stress, which they just don't need. As you said, so many people were busting out their sewing machines and making scrubs and things like that for the NHS, which is our UK health service. And I figured we could get all those people who were doing that to also make these and get them sent out to those in need.
Very practical question. A mask is fairly easy to sew, a rectangular piece of cloth and pleated. What about a menstrual pad?
I'd say just as easy. You know, I first learned to sew back in March. And so, you know, I had to borrow a sewing machine, had to look up tutorials on how to sew. So I figure if I can do it, then anyone can.
So the lack of access to period products and the stigma around menstruation, it can lead to huge knock-on effects, health and economic-wise, for women all around the world. How can reusable pads like these fight period poverty, as it's known?
They're a long-term solution. You know, I think so often organizations focus on providing disposable products, which I'm not knocking. It's a great thing, and we've done it ourselves. When refugees don't have washing facilities, these reusable pads aren't helpful. But I think the great thing about these is they last up to 3 to 5 years. So if you can give someone a set of these patcher pads, they're set. They don't have to worry about that any longer.
You're working with a number of aid organizations to distribute these products in Greece and Lebanon. Who specifically will be receiving them?
Yes, we're working with the Azadi Project in Lesbos, and they're actually a US organization. They're based in DC, and we're sending them out there to the women that they work with in Lesbos, and they're women in temporary accommodation, so they have access to washing facilities, but they've been through the Moria 2.0 camp, for example, which is quite famous for, you know, having horrible conditions. And then in Lebanon, we're also working with women in the refugee settlement, so they're living in tents, but they have access to washing machines, and so they're able to use these products.
And in the drive to make this a more sustainable project, I gather you're working with an organization that trains refugee women to sew these period products and sell them, correct?
Yeah, so we're doing that in Lebanon. This is a really exciting project to which we're launching this new year. So an organization called Wing Women in Lebanon, they already have a group of refugee women who, well, they provide them basic skills. They teach them how to sew. They do other education projects with them to make them more employable. And so we're working with them, and we're going to teach them how to make the pads so then they can sell them, generate a bit of extra income, but also, you know, use them themselves.
So one logistical thing that you've had to deal with is access to running water. It's hard to wash a reusable pad, obviously, if you don't have that. So some of the camps you've worked with are now in this situation. How do you deal with that really fundamental problem?
There is no one solution for period poverty. Other organizations provide women with cups, for example, and they're great because they last a lifetime, but they don't work for everyone, because in some cultures there's like the virginity issue and there's a purity issue with using them. And so I think the thing that we have to do is just target our distribution. So for example, with the Moria camp, where we weren't able to send out the patcher pads, we sent out disposables instead. And I think that's just what we have to do. We have to have a multifaceted approach as organizations dealing with period poverty.
So the Pachamama Project has been mobilizing volunteers in the UK, including people who had been making masks or gowns early in the pandemic. What kind of response have you gotten from volunteers over the past year?
It's been brilliant, actually. I mean, I really didn't expect it to grow this much. When I first started out, I just put a few messages on some Facebook groups, saw if there was anybody that could donate some fabric. And it grew so quickly. We've been reaching out to students, schools, everyone. It's been a really hard time for everyone. And I think it's good for people to feel useful. They're not just sitting around twiddling their thumbs. Like, they've got a project to do and they know that they're helping people. And I think that's really good for them, as well as it's good for the people that we're obviously distributing them to.
Ella Lambert, the founder of the Pachamama Project, which is creating reusable menstrual pads to distribute to refugees. Thank you for being with us, Ella.
Thank you so much for having me.
I haven't checked the charts in the U.S. lately, but I don't think we've got a Trust the Vaccine hit yet. Brazil does. The foundation for the song, though, that started 4 years ago and had nothing to do with COVID. That's MC Fiocchi and his track Boom Boom Tam Tam. Lyrically, pretty simple. Translated, the words go something like booty, 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 tom, tom, tom. The video features MC Fiocchi surrounded by women swinging their hips. It came out in 2017, racked up 1.5 billion hits on YouTube, more than any other Brazilian song ever. Here's the thing, Boom Boom Tam Tam sounds really similar to Butantan, as in the Instituto Butantan. It's been featured almost daily for the past year because it is the organization in Brazil that has been testing vaccine effectiveness. So everyone in Brazil knows the Instituto Butantan. And that's led to lots of riffs on MC Fiocchi's original tune, like this one from the classical Orquestra Sinfonica de Bahia. Easy enough for the flutist to grab the main theme, then a member of the orchestra in a tuxedo starts rapping fresh lines about trusting in Butantan and in the vaccine.
Ódio envolvente, que é inconsciente, e pra tá presente nos concertos da gente, toma vacina e vem sorridente.
After dozens of new versions of MC Fiocchi's track, MC Fiocchi himself decided to take back his song and support the fight against the virus with Vacina, Butantan.
Quem tá presente, a vacina é saliente, vai curar nós do vírus e salvar muita gente. Eu falei assim pra ela. Vai, vai no bom Butantan.
Except in his remix video, MC Fiocchi is no longer surrounded by a bunch of dancing women. He's at the Instituto Butantan, in one scene in a lab coat, in another dancing with the researchers on the roof of the institute. Call it MC Fiocchi's new good fight, from objectification to vaccination. And it's still easy to sing along to. A group of climbers from Nepal, arms locked together, singing their country's national anthem. That video was shot as they summited K2 in Pakistan. K2 is also known as the Savage Mountain. It's the second tallest in the world after Everest. The Nepalese recently made history because they were the first ever to successfully climb K2 in the winter. Despite the pandemic, there were other record-setting moments in the climbing world this year. One woman from the Gulf country of Oman summited Mount Amadablam in Nepal. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, her success is one of many recent achievements by Arab women mountaineers.
It took Navira Al-Harthi 2 years of preparation. She began her final ascent at 10:30 p.m. This was it, the summit of Mount Amadablam in Nepal at about 22,000 feet seemed so close.
I felt all the emotions, like I was nervous, I was happy, I was ready, I was not ready.
Ready or not, she had to begin. The 43-year-old climber from Oman set off with her team in the darkness. It was a long technical climb. They needed to stay focused, despite sub-zero temperatures, wind, low oxygen, and exhaustion. One small mistake could cost them their lives.
It was a long night.
There was one point, she tells me, when things started to look up.
I saw the sun from the other side. I was seeing all the colors. It was like between orange and yellow. And it's like, I forgot everything.
At around 11 a.m. on January 14th, Nadira Al-Harthi became the first Arab woman to summit Mount Amadablam. That's according to mountain records. In the pictures, she looks exhausted, but has a huge smile on her face.
I think I felt like the real happiness when you do something and you work very hard for that and you get it, you deserve it.
Al-Harthi did have to work hard to get here. She's one of a growing number of Arab women who are defying norms in conservative societies to follow their dreams of climbing mountains. Al-Harthi is a former geography teacher in Oman. In 2017, she met the first Omani man to climb Mount Everest and told him she wanted to climb Mount Everest too. He agreed to be her trainer. At first, she says she kept her dream a secret because her family and society in general wasn't ready to accept a woman mountaineer.
Sometimes people, they killed your dreams if you will start talking about. I didn't want to listen, yes, you can or you cannot. I don't want to evaluate my dream.
Of course, climbing Everest isn't cheap. Alharthi used up all her savings and took out a loan. No one would sponsor her at the time. 2 months before her expedition, Alharthi told her family what she was up to. They were confused and worried, she says. But she had made up her mind. On Mount Everest, Alharthi wasn't alone. She was part of a group of 4 Arab women who teamed up to climb Everest together. One of them was Mona Shahab from Saudi Arabia.
People ask me, Mona, are you married? I'm like, yes, married to the mountains. I'm in a polygamous marriage, literally, because I love the mountains.
Shahab says she too faced criticism and even outright hostility about her passion for climbing. Ahead of a previous expedition, a local publication in Saudi Arabia wrote about her trip.
The comments online were horrible. They were horrific. Basically kind of like condemning our parents and, you know, you guys are not good Muslims. Then how can you let your daughters go with men and all that?
One businessman went as far as writing a letter to the local governor, she says, demanding that the women's passports be taken away and they'd be barred from any future travel.
I was bothered, not for me, but I know my parents, especially my father, these comments bother him. It's not like he'll change his mind, but it's all about what society going to say in the end.
Shahab stuck with it. She climbed Kilimanjaro and Everest. For a while, she studied in the Netherlands, and now she's back in Saudi Arabia, getting ready for her next big climb, Denali in Alaska.
I'm going to be training in Saudi. Thank God, Saudi's not as flat as the Netherlands. So even though people are like, how do you train for a mountain in Saudi? I'm like, we do have sand dunes, and we do have some mountains in the western part of Saudi. Basically, what I do is I take a tire, and I have a harness on me, or a backpack, and I tie the tire and I pull it up sand dunes up and down, because Denali, what you're doing is you're pulling a minimum of 60 kg on a sled.
In this position, it makes them really heavy, especially in a very, you know, teeny tiny uphills.
In Lebanon, mountaineer Joyce Azam trains by pulling tires up and down mountains, just like Shahab does in Saudi Arabia. This is from a video she posted online. Azam climbed Everest with Shahab and Alharthi 2 years ago. She's the first Lebanese woman to complete the 7 tallest peaks on every continent. Born in 1984, Azam tells me her childhood was overshadowed by war.
I remember like missiles and bombing and fleeing and, you know, it was an aggressive childhood.
Azam went on to get a scholarship and study in Italy. She got a PhD in conservation of historical sites. She says she always had big aspirations, which didn't align with what her family and society deemed acceptable.
I didn't have the permission to dream because of my gender and because of my social class. Because, you know, like, why you want to pay $100,000 to climb a mountain?
She waited tables, she says, and found sponsors to pay for gear, training, travel, and all the rest. At the same time, she worked hard to convince her family that climbing was a worthy passion. Azam's perseverance paid off. In 2019, after reaching the summit of Mount Everest, the last one on her list of 7 summits, she called up her parents on a satellite phone.
And it was very emotional. I mean, I get emotional now because they told me, we are proud of you and we are sorry for all the adversity, you know, you had to go through. It was even better than climbing the top of the world.
Azam, Shahab and Alharthi say for them, mountaineering is not just about the accolades and the public recognition. It's about challenging mindsets and opening new opportunities for younger women.
In the mountains, the people who open the trail, you know, if there is no trail, they sweat more than the people who are behind, right? But what they do, there's the pleasure of opening the trail. And this is how I feel about it.
Mountaineering does come with its share of controversy. In 2019, at least 11 people died on Mount Everest. There were just too many people on the mountain, and some of them were not experienced enough. Rescuers and environmentalists say they want to see more attention to preserving lives and the natural beauty of the mountains. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Don't stop till you reach the top. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be strong, and as always, thanks for listening.